We're back in the parables. Language by necessity is a fluid medium. Every year, words and phrases are added to and deleted from the dictionary. There's something new all the time. Back in the 90s, a very popular phrase that was added to Funk and Wagnalls was yada, yada, yada. How many of you are old enough to remember yada, yada, yada? Where did it come from? Seinfeld, that's exactly right. It was the creation of one of the comedy writers for the sitcom Seinfeld. And it basically meant whatever and so on and so on. It was just kind of a placeholder. The writer had gotten it from his mother. His Yiddish mother would say yada, yada, yada when she didn't want to fill in a whole story and then come to the conclusion. And that was such a popular phrase for a short period of time, but unlike Seinfeld, it's gone the way of canceled sitcoms, and you won't see it anymore. But there are words that not only survive, but they thrive. Words that take on additional meaning, like the word hot, for example. Hot has always meant something that has an elevated temperature. Celsius, Fahrenheit, or whatever came before Celsius. I think before Celsius and Fahrenheit, it was just ouch. You know, I don't know what they had back then. I'm sure it was just ouch. But what else can hot mean in our world? What? Spicy. It can mean something that's good looking. Thank you. Was that? Oh, that was a definition. Okay. I just grab for compliments. Yeah, it can mean something that's good looking. It can mean merchandise that's stolen or just merchandise that's popular. It can mean a career that's taken off. It's hot. But there are words and phrases in language that just endure, and they never change their meanings. Nobody ever attaches another definition to them. They just endure from generation to generation, from century to century, from millennia to millennia, and one of those words is fool. The word fool has always been used to denote someone who is bereft of reason, someone who is lacking in discernment and intelligence. It's never been used as a compliment, oh, you fool, or he's a great fool. Nobody ever says that, at least not as a compliment. They may say it, but it's not a compliment. In Elizabethan times in England, if you called someone who was your superior a fool, you could actually go to jail. Think of some of the sayings we have about fool. What is a fool soon parted from? His money, yeah. There's no fool like an old fool. You notice there's never a saying that says there's no wise man like an old wise man. Wisdom is wisdom. Yeah, and where do fools rush in? Where angels dare not tread. There is no good connotation to the word fool. God is no less disdainful of the fool. The Bible's full of fool, F-U-L-L, of warnings about foolishness. Proverbs 10:8 says, a prating fool shall fail. Ecclesiastes 5:4 says, God has no pleasure in the fool. That's kind of sobering if you're a fool, isn't it? Of course, if you're a fool, you wouldn't know it applied to you. Oh, look, God has no pleasure in a fool. That displeasure with fools and foolishness is absolutely logical because foolishness is the antithesis of who and what God is. And not only is it the antithesis of who and what God is, it is the antithesis of what God created you and me to be. It's hard to believe watching the news, but man was created to be wise. Man, that's hard to believe. But we were created, all of us were created to be wise, to have discernment, to understand the truth, and to accurately apply that truth to everything we encountered during the day. Unfortunately, back in the Garden of Eden, somebody made a foolish choice. Hello. And ever since then, you and I and the rest of mankind has labored under the burden of foolishness. Who here has ever said, thought, or done something that in retrospect, it was pretty foolish? Good. 20% of you. Boy, this is a Mensa chapter, isn't it? Okay, 20% honest and the rest just embarrassed. That's all right. That's okay. I'll tell you 20%. We've all said, done. Sometimes, haven't you said something that even as it's coming out of your mouth, you're thinking, oh, this is stupid. Or you've done something and as soon as it's done, you thought, oh, that was not the best thing. Yeah, we labor under foolishness. But you know, there's a big difference between occasionally saying, thinking, or doing something that's foolish and living a life that is consumed by foolishness. The first is just an intermittent error, an occasional lapse in judgment. The second is a state of being, of going through your life, saying, thinking, doing things foolishly time after time after time. That's the fool that Jesus is addressing in our parable today. It's the parable of the rich fool. This parable is only found in the book of Luke. It's what we call an exemplary parable. If you were here during our introduction to parables, you might remember that an exemplary parable is one in which Jesus paints a portrait of either someone who has great conduct and we should follow their example, or really bad conduct and we should avoid their example. In the parable of the rich fool, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Good, bad thing, same 20%. Bad thing, that's right. It's a bad thing. This paints the portrait of conduct that we are to avoid. So we look today at Luke. Let's turn to chapter 12 of Luke, verses 13 through 21. I just want to look at the first verses 13 to 16 to start out. Jesus is out there preaching in Galilee, and someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he, Jesus, said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" Then he said, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." And he told them a parable. Think about the setting. Jesus is in Galilee. His popularity is big. Jesus is hot. There you go. See the tie-in? I came right back around to the introduction. Jesus' ministry is hot at this time. Everybody wants to hear Jesus. Everybody wants to see Jesus do a miracle. Everybody wants to be associated with Jesus. He's in front of a big crowd, and a request came out of that crowd. In verse 13, it said, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Now, on its face, doesn't that appear to be kind of a bland, innocuous request? I mean, his request, he didn't say, "Jesus, turn this stone into gold." Or, "Jesus, you know, give me wings that I could fly." This man made on its face what seemed to be a pretty innocuous request. He said, "Teacher," which tells you, what does he think of Jesus? Jesus is he's a teacher. What else is he to this guy? Not much else. He's a teacher. Jesus is this guy who's real popular, and he tells great stories, and he draws a crowd. That's who this guy in his mind is thinking. But in his response, we see four flaws in this man's character. And the only reason I'm stopping on this before we get to the parable, and we'll get to the parable, but I want to touch on this because do we ever bring petitions to God that seem kind of innocuous or innocent? I do. You know how I do it? Prayer. Yeah, prayer. I gave the P and the R. We do that every day. Every day we bring, in fact, if we're honest, most of our prayers probably consist of petitions. And we kind of throw it out there. We just keep asking you. We have this list, and maybe we pick up the prayer sheet from the lobby over in the main building, and we go through that, and we pray, and that's good. We should bring our petitions before God. But this man brought a petition, and in his position, he was flawed. And it's good for us to remember what the flaws were, because when we pray, we can fall into the same flaws. Four flaws, real quickly. He had a flawed attitude. He had a flawed attitude. This man came to Jesus and demanded what? Money. He demanded inheritance. On what basis did he have to ask Jesus for anything? Nothing. There was no basis. He came to Jesus. This was not a Q&A session. Jesus did not stand up there and say, "Anybody have any questions? Anybody want to see a miracle? Anybody want me to do anything?" Jesus was simply teaching. This man said, "Teacher, make my brother divide an inheritance with me." That is a demand. This man came to Jesus on the basis of what? Of obligation that Jesus was in, was, that this man was entitled to something from Jesus. Was this man entitled to anything from Jesus? No, nothing whatsoever. And yet he came with an attitude of entitlement. Had he established any basis for his claim on an inheritance? None whatsoever. This man came with an attitude of entitlement. He was entitled to Jesus' services. And let me tell you something, nobody's entitled to God's intervention. You know that? When we bring a request, it is a request. We are not entitled to God's intervention. We come with empty hands to God every time we come. It is not pro quo with God. It is, I got nothing and I need something. And he never established why he wanted the inheritance other than greed. And will God ever answer a prayer or request based on greed? No, the answer is no. There is no time where God will do this. When we go to God, we are, as Paul says, to come boldly before the throne of grace. But let me tell you something, we need to check our attitude before we go. We need to remember who we are and who God is. Second, this man had a flawed approach. In Israel at this time, there was an established process for litigating claims like this. You handled it this way. If you had a claim for an inheritance, you took your case to the rabbi of your local synagogue. You gave that rabbi kind of a thumbnail description of what you were claiming. And if that rabbi thought, hey, there might be something here, he'd set it for a hearing. And you'd have the opportunity to bring in witnesses. You'd have the opportunity to testify. You'd have the opportunity to bring in any documents. And so would the other side. What do we call that today? It's not a jury. It's just the rabbi. It's a one-man jury, but it's a trial. It's a trial. So there was an established process. Now, this man comes to Jesus, who is not a rabbi in a local synagogue. There's only one of three reasons this guy comes to Jesus instead of going the regular route. What are they?
Trip him up.
He had already been turned down. He tried it once and lost. Or he hadn't tried it, but he knew what? He would lose. Or he was just trying to shortcut the process. Those are the only three reasons why this man would have come to Jesus. None of which was a reason that Jesus would have honored. This man wanted to go to the court of public opinion either because he lost, he knew he would lose, or hey, this just looks like a good shortcut to get what I want. Jesus' response, look at that. Jesus said, "Who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" Did Jesus have the right to be a judge or arbitrator? He absolutely did. During his first incarnation, was that his mission? No, it wasn't. Will there come a time when Jesus is the ultimate judge? Oh yeah, whole rod of iron, sword out of the mouth. Gets ugly in Revelation. But absolutely, there will come a time when Jesus is the ultimate judge and arbitrator. But in that first incarnation, he was here to what? Seek and to save that which was lost. He was here to announce that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. He was here to give his life an atonement for many. Jesus had a number of missions in that first incarnation. Being the judge wasn't one of them. He didn't establish himself as a judge. He never held himself out as a judge. So when we come to God, we need to determine what our approach is to be. We are to come humbly before God. Third, he had a flawed heart. This man wanted to use God without having any particular use for God. He looked at Jesus as a means to an end. We see that in the world today. So a guy's driving through downtown New York City, and it's raining cats and dogs, and it's thundering and lightning, and the sky's dark, and he's late for the most important business meeting of his life. He can't find a parking garage. He finally, in desperation, says, "Lord, Lord, if you'll just show me a parking space, I swear I'll give up gambling, I'll quit drinking, and I'll go to church Sunday." And all of a sudden, it stops raining. And the clouds open, and the sun pours through, and there's spotlighted a perfect parking spot in front of the garage. And the man looks up and says, "Don't worry, I've got this one." That's the modern world's attitude toward God. They want to use God without having any particular use for God. He's a means to an end. Think about it. Think about the experience you've had in your life and you know, in the lives of the people you know. How many times have you known someone who has no use for God and then they get sick? Or someone in their family is diagnosed with cancer? Or somebody has no use for God, wouldn't darken the door of a church, but they lose their job or their business goes under. Or they have no use for God, but all of a sudden they find themselves charged with a crime and they're sitting down at the criminal courthouse. Let me tell you something. You go to any criminal courthouse Monday through Friday from about 8:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Those are peak hours. Walk up and down the halls, you'll see an unusually large number of Bibles. Not everybody will have a Bible, but it looks like the Gideons went through right before you. And most of the Bibles aren't open. They're just being clutched as that good luck charm. Maybe God will look through the halls of justice and see that I've got a Bible. And isn't there something there about the shield? Maybe it'll shield me. Happens all the time. Society. Now, don't get me wrong. There are many times when God uses difficulty and hardship to soften hearts and draw people to him. But overwhelmingly, God is viewed as a means to an end. People have a use for God at that point. They want to use God, use him and lose him. God becomes a get out of debt, get out of the hospital, get out of jail free card. A fool always thinks that he or she can manipulate God. So this man has a flawed attitude, a flawed approach, a flawed heart, and finally a flawed focus. What was the only thing this guy was worried about? All he wanted was what? Money. It was all about money. And as we saw, he has no basis for asking for money. He didn't care about justice. He didn't care about what was right or fair, about what was equitable. He was focused. He had a need, and he wanted that need met. You know, when we go to God, when we have a petition, we have a need. But examine the need and be open to God's answer regardless of what that answer is. You know, I think so often when Christians get frustrated over what they consider to be unanswered prayer, it's not unanswered prayer, it's just that a prayer wasn't answered the way they wanted it. You know, it's a prayer, it's not dictation. This man, in his simple request, demonstrated he was a flawed individual, flawed attitude, flawed approach, flawed heart, flawed focus, and it's so easy for us to fall into those same flaws when we go to God in prayer. Now let's go on to the parable. This parable involves someone who is rich, materially rich. But nowhere in this parable does Jesus condemn wealth. In fact, nowhere in Scripture does God condemn wealth. Why doesn't God condemn wealth? He grants it. Is wealth evil? Absolutely not. Gold has no conscience. Diamonds have no ulterior motives. You know, no matter what you have, stocks and bonds don't have a scheme. Wealth is an inanimate object. God never criticizes wealth in the Bible. In fact, the pursuit of wealth is a gift of grace. It's an exercise of common grace. God allows everyone in the world to pursue wealth. You know that? Every one of us, everyone in the world is free to pursue wealth. What does God condemn when it comes to wealth? God condemns a lot of things. What does God condemn as it relates to wealth? The love of it. What else? The what? If it masters you, becomes an idol. Absolutely. The abuse of it. Greed. Wealth at the expense of others. Now, wealth unfairly gained at the expense of others. Because realistically, if you're in the stock market and you buy a stock and you short a stock and somebody else goes long in a stock and you make money on a short and they lose money on a long, hey, you've made money at the wealth of others. But it's the unfair accumulation. God condemns the misuse and abuse of wealth. That really sums it up. And that's what Jesus addresses in the parable of the rich fool. It addresses the foolishness brought about by wealth. Why does, if the Bible doesn't condemn wealth, why does it say so much about wealth? Why do you think the Bible spends so much ink on wealth? It's what?
It reflects the attitude of the heart.
What else? It can be dangerous. Yeah, self-success. It can pump up the ego. Wealth has the potential for great fallout. And that's what the Bible always addresses, is the negative fallout of wealth. And so we look at it. And it's important to remember that while we're talking about material wealth in this parable, we can be wise in some areas of our lives and foolish in others. We can be wise in our management of financial wealth, but foolish in personal relationships. We can be wise in the way we pursue academic undertakings, but foolish as parents. We can be wise investors of money, but foolish investors of time. So really, the criticisms Jesus offers in this parable are directed at material wealth, but let's not forget, it's just not material wealth. It's all areas of our lives that are impacted. So, back to Luke 12, we read the parable, starting at the end of verse 6, or we'll start it with 16. He told them a parable, saying, now keep in mind, he's already just nailed this guy. He said, I'm not your judge. Hey, everybody, be careful about possessions. And then he told them a parable, saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? Then he says, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. That's where that phrase comes from, you know, eat, drink, and be merry. That's where that comes from. But God said to him, you fool, you never want to hear God say that. How about, well done, thou good and faithful servant? But let's all hope we never pop up and God looks at you and says, oh, you fool. This very night, your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? Here's the punchline for the parable. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. In this parable, Jesus lays out the life of a fool. And he lays it out by detailing or demonstrating four things a fool forgets. That's why I called this amnesia. Because a fool forgets four essential things as it relates to wealth. And let me suggest, if you take nothing else away from this lesson today, remember these four things and you will walk out wiser than when you walk in the door. And your life will be wiser if you just allow these things to be applied. The fool forgets. He forgets the giver. He forgets others. He forgets his personal mortality. And he forgets eternity. Let me tell you something. There aren't four things more important. First of all, the fool forgets the giver. Look at verses 17 through 19. In those three verses, this man uses personal pronouns 13 times. I, my, thy, thou, 13 times in three verses. Who else does he mention? No one. He mentions no one. A fool forgets everyone in his life, especially the source of his good things. To a fool, his life is a motion picture and he's the star. The problem here, as is the problem with wealth, is not that this man possessed things. The problem is that this man was possessed by his things. That's the problem. It's what some theologians call the quicksand of wealth. It draws us in, and before we know it, we are under it. We start out walking up to it, we stand on it, but before we know it, we have sunk down and we're trapped by it. It's the quicksand of things. It's the dark side of material blessings. Taking what God has given us, taking that gift of grace, because all good things are a gift of grace, and becoming so enamored of them that that's all we see. We don't see the source. And the response, the wrong response to getting wealth, if we have wealth, what's the first thing we want to do? Well, we want more. That's the second thing. Yeah, first thing is keep it. We want to keep it, and we want more. That's the attitude.
That attitude has bankrupted more than one person in the history of America. They want to keep it, and they want more and more and more. What's the response to this man? How do we know that he wanted to keep it and get more? What was his response? I've got a great crop coming in. Now what do? I store it. I store it. In fact, what do I have to do to store it? Yeah, I have to tear down the barns I have. And let me tell you something. That tells you how wealthy this man is or was and how big the harvest was. Because if you've lived in a farm area at all, barns are not cheap or easy to build or tear down now, much less then. This was a very labor-intensive society. But this man was so wealthy, he said, I'm just going to tear everything down and build more. And he wanted to build more because he wanted to what? Store more. He wanted to accumulate. He already had enough. When this parable began, he already had enough. His barns were bursting. But instead of disposing of the new harvest in a more equitable way, all he wanted to do was build bigger barns so that he could keep more for himself. In Matthew 6:25, Jesus pointed out that life is much more than what we eat or what we wear. Material possessions are here today and gone tomorrow. Now, don't forget, when this parable is given, Israel is still under the sacrificial system. And under the sacrificial system, harvest time was a time for sacrifice. You had to bring in grain offerings. Where is any mention in this man's diatribe that he set anything aside for sacrifice? Yeah, there is none. There is none. This man got it, and he was going to keep it. Interestingly, in the Jewish culture of Jesus' time, wealth was considered sure proof of God's approval. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, yeah. In fact, a common saying among rabbis was, whom the Lord loveth, he maketh rich. Give them a radio or a television and they're home free. This man was disregarding the law and customs. And what commandments was he breaking? At least two commandments in his attitude toward his wealth. And forgetting the source, what was the first commandment he was disregarding? Number one. Yeah, number one. Loving the Lord with all your heart. What was another commandment he was violating? Coveting. Well, coveting. He didn't really covet because he already had it. So he wasn't coveting what somebody else had. What was his attitude toward his stuff? Idols, idolatry. Yeah, become an idol. That's what he was focusing on. Anything that we focus on instead of God is our idol. Our use of material blessings is an excellent barometer. It's an excellent barometer today of our obedience to God and our love for God. Think about, and I'm not going to ask for hands now or personal examples, but think about how you use the good things that God has given you. If you really had to sit down and justify or itemize or inventory how you use the material blessings God has provided you with today, does that reflect that you love the Lord with all your heart and with all your strength and with all your might? Or does that reflect that maybe there's a little idolatry that's gone in there? Today, I think too many Christians have what's called a spare change mentality. God is welcome to everything I don't need. The problem is, if that's the standard, how much don't we need that we have? Not much. We need just about everything we have. We can find a use for all our material wealth. We can find a use for all our time. We can find a use for all our talents. Everything we have, we can find a use other than the kingdom of God. Let me tell you something. To keep in mind the source of every good thing requires effort, and it has to be lived out. A fool forgets the source. How many times in a week, and again, not asking for hands, how many times in a week do you honestly take partial inventory of the good things in your life? Knowing, of course, as James says, that every good gift comes from God. How many times do you deliberately say, okay, here's five good things today, five good things that God has provided for me, and thoughtfully and deliberately thank God for those things? Five things. This week, try that. I mean, I know that's 35 things. God's given you more than 35 good things. You'll never have to repeat, I guarantee you. A fool forgets the source. And when you forget God, you won't remember anything of any use. Second, the fool forgets others. Rarely does anyone attain great wealth by him or herself. Someone is always there to contribute. Our fool was what? What was his job? He was a farmer. He was a farmer. This was a largely agrarian society. Our fool was a farmer. Now, has anybody here ever been a farmer, grew up on a farm? Here we have a few. My son-in-law, Mickey, grew up on a dairy farm. I mean, you talk about getting up at 4:30 in the morning and going out and milking the cows, and then going to school and coming home and milking the cows, and plowing and planting. I grew up in farm country in Illinois. I never wanted to be a farmer. Two things I never wanted to be coming out of high school: pastor and farmer. Dad was a pastor. I saw, that's way too hard. My friends' dads were farmers. I thought, that's just as hard as being a pastor. At least the cows don't sass. But a farmer, first of all, who does a farmer need? God. He needs God. What does God provide a farmer? Rain. Soil. Sunshine. Labor. Growth. Everything. Everything a farmer has, God provides. But who else does this farmer rely on? On his workers. Well, yeah. If he has farmers, if a farmer has family, they'll be workers. But he relies on his labor force. This farmer had an abundant crop, which indicates he probably had quite a bit of land. And now, as then, farming was a very labor-intensive profession. I mean, you want to see people who work hard go out and stay at a farm. In Jesus' day, farmers were mostly migrant workers. They would actually migrate through the nation of Israel, north to south, actually usually south to north, hitting different times for preparing land, sowing, and harvesting. Oh, you'd have a few people who could hook on with a large landowner to work year-round, but by far, most of the people were migrant workers. When I was in high school, I used to work for a large grocery store in the suburbs south of Chicago, and we had a bunch of truck farms in our area, and migrant workers would come in mid to late August, early September, to harvest onions, for the most part. Onions. But that's okay. But I always knew when the migrant workers were coming in, because all of a sudden we'd start stocking like 20 to 50 pound bags of dried rice and dried beans and just flour. That's how I always knew them. And I always thought, and they'd come in the families, and I'd carry out their stuff to their beat up pickups. I think, this is a hard life. Well, it was a harder life when this parable was given. These people were paid basically, as we know, a denarii or a penny a day, enough to live on for one day. If you really were a good migrant worker, you might get 6 or 7 months a year of work following the tilling and the planting and the harvesting. What's the problem with getting 6 to 7 months? There's 12 months in a year. Yeah. And it's not like you can go into hibernation. You are scrounging for a living for the last 4 or 5 months that you're not employed. This man had abundance. Now, he was already rich before the parable began. Jesus made a point of that. Remember, he said a rich fool bursting barns. At no time, his life was defined by excess. At no time does he give any thought to who? To his workers, to the people who helped him. Now, the Bible is not the basis for socialism or communism. But the Bible God does require an equitable treatment of the people who work for you. In Colossians 4:1, Paul gives a clear directive that employers are to give their employees what is fair and just. Now, I know that is a moving target, fair and just. But here, a huge harvest coupled with a pre-existing wealth and the obvious need of the workers mandated what? Some sort of distribution of wealth. Some sort of distribution just to share. But he forgot everyone from whose labors he had benefited. This man just went on. Does this remind you of anybody from the Old Testament? guy named Nabal. Remember Nabal? Yeah, I remember Nabal. Oh, you remember old Nabal? That's an old boy. Nabal. Nabal forgot the labors of who? David and David's 200 armed men. You know, if you're going to forget anybody's labors, make sure they don't have like a small army behind them. That's one of the side lessons from that. If you're going to cheat somebody, make sure they're not armed. Just a thought. But you remember at the end of Nabal's harvest, David's men came and said, hey, look, we've served you. We've protected your flocks. We've protected your crops. We've protected your workers. How about a little something for the effort? And Nabal said, I don't know who you people are. And Nabal's servants came to him and said, oh, no, these are good guys. They protected us, and they protected the flocks, and they protected the harvest, and you really should help them. And Nabal said, I don't know who these guys are. And remember, Nabal's servants became very fearful. Why were they fearful? Yeah, they knew they were armed. Nabal's servants had seen these guys for months, and they knew this guy has an army. And in fact, you remember what David said he was going to do? He was going to kill everybody. Not one of David's better moments. But when the word came back to David, he said, that's it, they're dead. Thankfully, Abigail, Nabal's wife, intervened. She gave David and his men what they were due. And what happened when Nabal found what she had done? Yeah, he had a stroke and basically died. He was so angry. Yeah, he stroked out and died. And Abigail, I love Abigail's description of her husband. She said, Nabal, which means fool. Fool is his name, and folly is with him. Or there's no fool like an Old Testament fool. Yeah. Our fool forgot his employees. But then again, he forgot everybody. Who else didn't he mention? He didn't mention God. He didn't mention his workers. Who else didn't he mention? He didn't mention his family. He didn't mention his friends. And he didn't mention the poor. Now, you could argue that, well, family and friends will indirectly benefit from this guy. But this guy never mentioned the poor. He chose to forget the poor in Israel. Throughout his word, we see God's concern for the poor. I know Ronald Reagan misquoted the Bible when he said, well, the poor will always be with you to justify, but I like Reagan, but that wasn't one of his finest hours. But in the Bible, in Leviticus 19:10, he says that God commands, don't glean the fields, don't glean the vineyards. Who really benefited from that? Ruth. Yeah, Ruth did fine with that one. Proverbs 14:21. Blessed is the man who has pity on the poor. I try to remember that verse. Blessed is the man who has pity on the poor. And when God says, have pity on the poor, he means more than just feel sorry for the poor, regrets the poor, has some sort of connection with the poor. When God says, I'm going to bless the person who has pity on the poor, what does he want that person to do? Help the poor. Yeah, this is a proactive charge. It is not pity in a passive sense. The pity that God honors, the pity that God demands, is proactive pity. It's proactive pity. One day, a year, in Jesus' time, everyone in the nation of Israel was mandated to come out to bring clothes, food, money, jewelry, to give it to all the poor they could find and take the excess to the synagogue so that it could be used as benevolence the rest of the year. This man shows no indication that he had any desire to share. He had so much excess, he was going to tear it down and rebuild. He dishonored God. God never mandates that we sacrifice necessities to help the poor, but he does command proactive use of the resources we have. How can we do this? Benevolence. We can volunteer time and money. We can identify those agencies, those groups that would benefit from the excess God has given us. Face it, the word excess indicates we don't need it. The fool forgets the source, and he forgets others, but he forgets his own mortality. You know, a common saying is that someone lives as if there's no tomorrow. You ever heard that? My mom would always use that about anybody who seemed to be having too much fun. Well, he's living like there's no tomorrow. Well, gee, Mom, maybe you'd like to enjoy today. I don't know. A fool's problem is not that he lives like there's no tomorrow. A fool's problem is that he lives as if there are infinite tomorrows. A fool lives as if he will always enjoy this life, and he will always enjoy it, at least in this degree of comfort and health, that tomorrow never comes. What tells us that this is this fool's mindset? What did he say to himself? In verse 19, it says what? I will say to my soul, hey soul, you have many goods laid up for what? Many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. In Proverbs, we read it's the unspoken thought of every man's heart that he will live forever. The fool lives out that verse. What does the Bible say about our lifespan? In Hebrews 9:27, it is what? Appointed unto man once to die. There is a time when we will die. We do not have an excess of tomorrows. We do not have an infinite number of tomorrows. Yeah, we want to talk about eternity. I'm talking on this earth. We do, and we need to live accordingly. Because what does the second half of Hebrews 9:27 say? It's appointed unto man once to die, and what? After that, the judgment. It's payday someday. A fool always forgets there's payday. And when you forget there's payday, what attitude does that encourage in your life today? If there's no payday, if there's no accountability, what can I do now? Eat, drink, and be merry. That kind of sums it up, doesn't it? Who do you answer to? Yourself. Who are you dependent on? No one, yourself. You are independent. You are self-reliant. You answer only to yourself. Life becomes all about you. Other people don't really matter. Things are more important than people. God always places more emphasis on people than things. The fool forgets that tomorrow will come. When I was in grade school, I had a Sunday school teacher, Mr. Eisnagel. And that was really his name, Eisnagel. His wife tried to teach me piano once. Once. I think I was the only person who only made it once. But Mr. Eisnagel used to teach us. I was in fourth or fifth grade. It was a boys' class. And Mr. Eisnagel was always trying to impart wisdom to us. Just a sweet guy. And one of the things he talked about was how important it was to live every day as if it was your last day. And he said, boys, you should always end each day with a clean slate. That was his favorite topic, a clean slate. Clean slate with your family, clean slate with your friends, clean slate with God. Don't forget that, boys, a clean slate. A fool never sees the slate. He forgets he doesn't have infinite tomorrows. Finally, a fool forgets eternity. He forgets the next life, and face it, that's the life that really matters. A fool gives no thought to the next life. John Wesley, one of the founders of the Methodist Church, when it was still a good church, John Wesley used to say, our people die well. That was one of his favorite sayings. Our people die well. Sounds a little morbid. It's not like Rosebud, which is a better line, but our people die well. Thank you, my movie aficionados. The only way one dies well is if you die prepared. And a fool never prepares for death. A fool doesn't prepare to death. One dies after becoming, as Jesus says in verse 21, so is the man who stores up treasure for himself, and here it is, and is not rich toward God. You die well if you die rich toward God. Well, that begs the question, doesn't it? How in the world does one become rich toward God? Certainly, we don't become rich toward God from the standpoint of God owes us something. God owes us nothing. But how do we bank with God? Let me suggest we do it the same way we cultivate wealth in this earth, material wealth. We do it the old-fashioned way. We what? We earn it. We earn it. This is not about salvation, okay? We're not talking about how does anybody earn salvation. I'm talking about how does a believer become rich toward God? We earn it. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, and you can turn there if you want. I'll read it if you don't want to. It's 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 18. Paul outlines how you and I can become rich towards God. Remember these verses. Paul says to Timothy, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on this uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. We'll go to verse 19. Storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. When Paul says, storing up for themselves treasure of a good foundation for the future, what future is he talking about? He's talking about eternity, yeah. He's not talking about when you retire. Paul's talking about return. Here's five things, remember. Here's how you get rich towards God. Don't be arrogant. And if we remember God, and this will be addressed, don't be arrogant. If you remember that God is the source of every good thing you have, you won't be arrogant. But there's step one, don't be arrogant. If we get arrogant, another word for arrogant is what? Pride, yeah. Another word for, don't be prideful. If we are prideful toward what we have, let me tell you something, then it's all because of us. And we'll never see God. So don't be arrogant. Second, don't trust in money. Paul says, don't fix your hope on the uncertainty of riches. Don't trust in money. Let it go. It's only paper. Be wise in how you use it. Be wise in how you use it. But never look on money or your possessions as your primary source of security. Material possessions are designed only to be used in this life. If that weren't so, we could take it with us. Third, enjoy life without being selfish. Enjoy life without being selfish. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. Give from your excess. If you give from your excess, God will always make sure there's enough. But you have to be satisfied with God's definition of enough. That's a tough one. Do good works. Use your time and money to benefit others. And finally, be generous as God is generous to you. Be generous as God is generous to you. If you use those 5 points as a yardstick, you will be rich toward God. When John Paul Getty died, he was worth, in today's dollars, billions of dollars. Estimates go anywhere from $12 to $20 billion when Getty died. Shortly after his death, someone ran into Getty's lawyer. And the guy said, just confidentially, how much did he leave? And Getty's lawyer looked at him and he said, all of it. Yeah, that's what we leave here. In our material possessions, it doesn't matter how big the house is you live in, it doesn't matter how nice the car is you drive, it doesn't matter how much you have in the bank, when you die, you'll leave it all. You'll leave it all. The only wealth we keep is what we deposit in heaven. The fool makes no deposits. How rich are you towards God? Here's the good news. The bank's always open, and it always takes deposits. Now, you may be here this week and you think, okay, that's a good lesson on foolishness. I'm covered. I recognize there's a God. I don't forget him. I think about others from time to time. I know my own mortality. I won't live forever. And yes, there's an eternity, and I'm pretty well squared away with that. But remembering involves more than just some vague acknowledgement that something exists. True memory will always be evidenced by our conduct. We know, we remember that we have to eat to survive, and we don't miss a meal, even if it's just a green donut on a Sunday morning. But we remember. We remember that we don't live in a clothing-optional society, and so we get dressed before we leave the house. We remember that if we don't show up for work, they don't pay us, and we show up for work. We live out what we remember. With that template, how does your life truly reflect that you remember God? How does your use of your time, your talents, your money reflect that you love the Lord your God with all your heart and that you view him as more than just a spare change God? How often do you stop, itemize just half a dozen of the blessings he's given you and thank him deliberately for those things? What evidence in your life is there that you remember others, that you extend yourself beyond your family and your friends to help somebody else in need? Whatever form that takes, when's the last time you helped somebody outside your family or friends or church? That's for you to answer. But that shows how much you remember others. How do you reflect that you remember your own mortality? Do you basically live for today thinking, yes, I know life is short and eventually I'll die, but not today and not tomorrow? How hard do you try to keep a clean slate in your life? And mortality, what are you banking in heaven? That's eternity. What are you banking in heaven? This week, don't be a fool. Remember God and deliberately remember God and thank Him. Use what He's given you for the advancement of His kingdom. Remember others. Proactively look for an opportunity to benefit someone outside yourself and your family. Remember, you don't live forever on this earth. The best you can, end each day with a clean slate toward your family, your friends, and God. And proactively lay up treasures in heaven. Let me tell you something, you do those four things, you'll be wiser next Sunday than you are today. Let's close in prayer. And Lord God, we confess we are so often foolish in our lives. We thank you that you are the source of all wisdom and that, Lord, you will give it to us abundantly if we ask. This week, help us to deliberately remember you. Help us to deliberately live in that memory. Help us to live to advance your kingdom in our lives. Help us to remember others. Lord, show us opportunities to benefit someone outside our immediate friends and family. And help us to step out in faith and do it. Lord, help us to remember our own mortality. You warn us time and time again that our life is short. Well, Lord, help us to live the short life. Help us to live wisely. Help us to keep that slate clean. And Lord, help us to deliberately lay up riches, not because you'll ever owe us anything, but because it delights you when we lay them up. Lord, may we be wiser tomorrow than we are today. And we pray this in your name. Amen.